Today, we're sitting down with Daniel Pink. Daniel is the best-selling author of 4 provocative books translated into 29 languages, including A Whole New Mind and his latest book, Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Previously, he was a speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore, but has now focused his talents in motivating and bringing change into the world of business. Today, we're privileged to get his thoughts and insights on how motivation has morphed over time and how we could use that to build a better business. Daniel, great to be with you here, and welcome to Success.
It's a pleasure being on Success. I've been a fan for a long time.
Okay, so let me start off with this question. I've heard you say that the science of motivation is a bit, quote unquote, freaky, that humans are not as manipulated and predictable as we might think. What we know about rewards and punishments is not completely accurate. So tell us more about this and explain why higher rewards don't necessarily translate into higher performance.
Yeah, that's really the crux of this set of ideas. We have this kind of these assumptions about what motivates people that are fairly simple and that aren't altogether wrong either. We believe that if you reward something, you get more of that behavior. If you punish it, you get less of that behavior. And it turns out, if you look at 50 years of science, that that's true a lot of the time. But it's not true all the time. And there are many, many instances where it gets, as you say, freaky, where you can reward behavior and get less of it, and you can punish behavior and get more of it. And I guess the core idea here, as you said, is to get past a few kind of assumptions here. One assumption is that carrot and stick motivators work really well for all things. That just is flatly untrue. The other thing is I think we have to get past these assumptions about other people, which is that human beings are like sophisticated robots, and if you just press the right lever the right way, people will do what you want them to do, what you expect them to do. That's just flatly untrue. And also, I think a more dangerous assumption is basically to assume that people are inherently blobs, that they're inherently passive and inert, and that if you didn't dangle a carrot in front of them or wield a stick behind them, people would just sit there and do nothing. I don't think that is human nature. I think human nature is to be active and engaged. And so, again, if you take a really hard-headed look at the science, it leads you into some seemingly soft-hearted conclusions, which is that carrots and sticks don't work a heck of a lot of the time, and that there are other deeper, higher motivations that end up working a lot better.
Let me drill down on this.
Yeah.
Does the carrot and stick work to a certain point? And then what's that point? And then what happens after that point?
That's a really good way to look at it. What I talk about are if-then motivators, as in if you do this, then you get that. Those kinds of motivators, those if-then motivators, work really well for simple, routine kinds of tasks. Turning the same screw the same way on an assembly line, stuffing envelopes, adding up columns of figures. The evidence is pretty clear that if-then motivators for simple tasks are fine. They work pretty well. They get you to focus. They get you to barrel ahead to the conclusion. The problem is that once you, and this is really the point that you're describing, once you get past a certain, level of, I guess, complexity or sophistication in a task, once it calls for any amount, even small amounts of conceptual thinking, creativity, complexity, those if-then motivators end up backfiring many times. They end up either being ineffective or actually doing harm. The other thing, which I think is really important, is that if-then motivators tend to work reasonably well in the short term. If you were to offer me $500 for standing on the chair in this studio rather than sitting on the chair in this studio, I'm there, man. You know, $500 for that, I'm there. It can motivate people in the short term. The problem is that it ends up being kind of people metabolize it very quickly. They burn it up very, very quickly. And so it's really those two thresholds that matter the most.
Let me ask you about this dynamic then. Okay, you talked about if it gets too complex, and then the second point was it could be motivating for a very short period of time. I interviewed Tom Rath recently, and he made a point that said, you know, once you get past a certain income level, and I think it was as small as like $80,000 or $90,000 a year, motivation mm-hmm. for the financial
incentive drops off dramatically. What are some of your findings and research said about the financial lever dropping off after somebody reaches a particular level of comfort or a level of financial security? Is there anything in that mix that you have found?
One of the things that I've discovered, particularly in larger enterprises, is that I think what we're seeing right now, especially at this moment in time when there is this palpable sense that a page has turned, I think we're seeing in some ways the limits of the profit motive as a motivator. Now, just to be clear before, you know, people wig out on me here, the profit motive is a very good thing. It's a good thing for efficiency. It's a good thing morally. But it's not the only thing. And I think in many cases, it's insufficiently motivating. So let's say you're inside of a large public company and the rallying cry inside the company is, let's raise earnings per share 4 cents this quarter. I mean, that's a worthy goal, but it's not the kind of thing that makes most people leap out of bed in the morning to do something extraordinary. I think, as I said, it's insufficiently motivating. And I think more and more in successful businesses, they combine the profit motive with what you might think of as the purpose motive, which is this idea that successful companies, large and small, stand for something and contribute to the world. And I think when you pair the profit motive and the purpose motive, really good things can happen. Again, you know, there's this mythology that carrots and sticks work for all things, when in fact, they don't work for all things. And over the last 50 years, scientists have found out that another set of motivators, a sense of autonomy, a sense of mastery, and a sense of purpose are really what lead to enduring motivation.
Okay, so you leapt forward into my next question. So let's go there. Let's go right there, because I want to be sure that we set the proper foundation and context for the conversation. So we've talked about the profit motive, and you touched on the purpose motive, and you alluded to a couple of others. But tell us all the different types of motivators there are and how they have the potential to fuel high performance.
Got it. Okay. So again, what we're setting out here is that carrot and stick motivators, if then motivators, are great for simple tasks, great for routine tasks, less great for the complicated, complex tasks. What works better if you harvest the science of motivation are three things. Autonomy. And autonomy is our sense of self-direction, that is, being able to control, especially at work, when we work, how we work, what we actually do, and who we do it with. And when people have control over those elements of their work, they end up being engaged. And again, if you look at the broader workforce, there is this kind of alarming amount of disengagement out there in the workplace,
mm-hmm.
Measured by Gallup and others. I mean, the engagement numbers are shocking.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that is that we're trying to manage people into engagement. And no one ever, the human beings don't engage that way. The only way that human beings engage is by getting there themselves through self-direction. And so autonomy ends up being this incredibly powerful force for enduring motivation, for especially for the more complicated and creative tasks. Now, and we can talk later on about some of the really interesting things some companies are doing. So that's autonomy. Mastery is our desire to get better at stuff. And the reason we like to get better at stuff is because we like to get better at stuff. It's inherently satisfying. It's a very powerful motivator. And I think in many cases, our workplaces are not set up to allow people to make progress, to shine a light on progress, to recognize progress. So we have autonomy, that's mastery. And finally, which we talked about a little bit, is a sense of purpose. People do what they do better when they know why they're doing it, not just how they're doing it. And in many cases, inside of organizations, managers especially, have this obsessive focus on how. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do this. But we very rarely have conversations about why. You know, why am I doing this in the first place? And when people know why what they're doing matters, when they know how it contributes to the larger whole, when they actually can do what they do and affect the world in a way, that's powerfully motivating. And so if we really want enduring motivation in our businesses especially, but even in our personal lives, we really want to focus on autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
You know, I really like the idea that you're talking about in terms of mastery here, and the key point being progress, because I think that's what people are yearning for, because it involves an element of recognition. And it's not only recognition from outside, where you are either being acknowledged for the progress that you're making because it's measurable and it was a milestone reached, but I think it's also internal. It's a sense of accomplishment. Okay, I've done that. Now there's a momentum to accomplishment that I think is necessary to continue to fuel progress. I was with Tony Hsieh yesterday, and he was talking about how he had a track for somebody to get promoted that took 36 months, and they were promoted once in between that at 18 months. And it was difficult to keep the motivation long enough to have them complete the entire track. So they ended up creating smaller milestones along the way. So they always felt like they were accomplishing and moving forward, that sense of progress that you talked about. So I think that could be applied to a lot of companies. He even said it didn't cost us any more money to do it, but everybody's motivation was far greater because they were being recognized for their progress, but not only externally, but also internally.
I think that's so important. It's not as if people always need to be, you know, celebrated and adored and given prizes for making progress. In fact, I think that can actually work against it. But people need to have a sense of how they're doing and where they are. It's really what Tony's describing is in some ways a form of feedback.
Right.
We don't have these rich, regular, robust feedback systems in our workplaces. And I think that's another reason for the disengagement. People just don't have a sense of whether they're making progress.
Yeah. And I have a quote here from your book that you write, quote, "There's a mismatch between what science knows and what business does." So in your studies and work, what's the major reason you found for this mismatch? You know, what has created this gap in knowledge versus business practice?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I've cracked the nut on it. I mean, it's sort of alarming in a way, because what you have is you have this, you know, 50 years of science that says one thing, and then a set of practices inside of companies that are not doing that, and that are really lodged more in folklore rather than in the research. And, you know, you wouldn't go to a doctor who says, "Oh, I have a folklore cure for how to fix your disease," or you wouldn't have somebody build a house that says, "Instead of using modern engineering, I'm going to use folklore about how a building stands up." It's a really frustrating question. I think there are a few reasons for it. Number one is the nature of work has changed. As I mentioned before, those if-then motivators, they work pretty well for simple routine tasks. And I think we sometimes forget that not too long ago, most people in most organizations and most many, many functions within the economy were doing relatively simple routine work. Blue collar work was sort of turning the same screw the same way. White collar work was following processes, processing information, following set of rules and so forth. And if then motivators work well for that. The problem is that fewer and fewer and fewer of us are doing that kind of work. And we haven't yet updated our motivational system to how people are really working. So that's one thing. The second thing is, which we talked about before, is that if-then motivators, they get a response in the short term. There's no question about it. If you have a team and you want them to come up with, say, a new product idea, and you say to your six-person team, "Whoever comes up with a new product idea, I'll give a $15,000 bonus." People are going to work. They're going to respond to that. They're going to scurry around. You're going to get action. Now, the research is pretty clear that you're less likely to get really creative breakthrough ideas that way, but people will respond. And I think sometimes managers get faked out when they see people, working furiously, thinking that they're doing something that actually accomplishes the objective. So that's another reason. I think a third reason, Darren, is that they're easy. It's much easier for me to say, again, go back to this idea of I got a six-person team. It's much easier for me to say, $15,000 to whoever comes up with something awesome. That's easy. It's harder to look at Maria and say, okay, who is Maria? What is Maria about? How do I put Maria in the positions where she can have a sufficient amount of autonomy? What kind of progress does Maria need to make? What is Maria's really abiding purpose? Does she want to make a contribution to a larger enterprise? Does she want to change the world? That's really hard. And so I think it's those things. It's a combination of these things having worked in the past, it's a combination of these things having worked in the past, of producing action in the short term, and of being pretty easy. That makes them very, very stubborn, very difficult to erase.
And I want to amplify your second reason there, which is that it works in the short term. Because having studied motivation for a long time myself, and obviously at Success, we do that as part of our regular practice. The one thing that I have found is that, you know, stirring motivation in the short term is not difficult. And it is something that everybody can get motivated in the short term, and that's not a problem. We all start, right? We all sign up for,
you know,
new gym memberships. We all make New Year's resolutions. We all buy the books. We all go to the seminars. We all start. So the initial motivation is not the problem. Sustained motivation is the problem. So the $15,000, you know, immediate reward is going to start motivation, but it's not going to sustain it. And that's where your other key motivators have to come in, where your motivators of purpose and autonomy and mastery and being able to see, measure, and recognize your own progress along the way. It's the difference between throwing gas on the fire versus putting slow-burning logs that will keep the fire burning all night long, or in many cases, all year long, so that you can accomplish your big, hairy, audacious goal. So that is such a key point about the difference between short-term motivation triggers and what fuels short-term motivation versus the important and more elusive issue, which is how do you sustain motivation over a long period of time. So let's bring this into some tangible references that we can point to. What are some company examples where people have implemented some of these either purpose, autonomy, or mastery motivators and have proven them successful? Can you point us to a couple of companies or a few examples?
Oh, sure. Yeah. On autonomy, I think some of the examples there are really, really interesting. So one of my favorite is an Australian software company called Atlassian. And they do something really cool. Once a quarter on Thursday afternoons, they say to their software developers, go work on anything you want, as long as it's not part of your regular job. Do it the way you want. Do it with whoever you want. So you have autonomy over your technique. You have autonomy over your team. The only thing we ask is that you show what you've created to the rest of the company on Friday afternoon in this fun freewheeling meeting. They call these things FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. Well, it turns out that this one day, okay, we're talking one day of intense autonomy, has led to this whole array of ideas for new products, a whole even larger number of fixes for existing products, ideas for improving processes within the company. And these are things that had otherwise never emerged. All right, so it's a very different approach to motivation. It's not dangling a carrot in front of someone and saying, if you do something nice, I'll give you a carrot. It's saying, let me get out of your way because you probably have some great ideas. You probably want to do something good. And so let me just reconfigure the environment so you can actually do that.
Aren't there some famous examples of Google as well as Toyota doing this very same practice?
Sure. I mean, Google does it at an even more intense way. So at Google, people can spend 20% of their time working on whatever they want. Now, again, I just want to be clear that this is a very, very hard-headed approach to business. It's not as if Atlassian or Google signs away the intellectual property rights to what's created during that 20% time. But what they do is they block out that time for what we can think of as non-commissioned work. And that's really where a lot of the action is. So if you look at Google, it's remarkable. If you can look at any of Google's broad innovations, and if you trace their genesis, they almost always begin in 20% time. Look at Gmail, where it seems like everyone and their brother has a Gmail account right now. Gmail was not an official project. It was someone's 20% project. And this is really and there's so many other really interesting examples like this, Darren. This is really the approach that I think the more cutting edge, forward thinking companies are doing to really foster motivation.
Do you have any examples where a company has used mastery as the key, or let's just say one of the motivators to increase performance?
Well, I mean, there are companies out there that are actually pushing back on this by actually establishing, sort of like what you're talking with Tony Hsieh, this more rapid feedback loop. In larger enterprises, feedback usually comes in an annual performance review. Okay. annual feedback is a joke. You're not going to get better at anything if you get feedback on it once a year. I mean, it's actually kind of comical when you think about it. If you think about, say, a great golfer or a great tennis player playing for a year and then getting feedback once a year in a 45-minute awkward conversation with her boss. I mean, it's a silly way to get feedback on things. So you have some companies that are doing monthly feedback or even weekly feedback. You have some companies, again, in software that practice what's called agile software development, where the people on the team will meet every day, set out their goals, meet the next day, give each other feedback. And these little sessions that they call scrums. There are other interesting ways of enriching the feedback environment there. Google does this. Again, I don't want to single out Google as the be all and end all. There are even smaller companies. There's an interesting engineering company in North Carolina that does this, where at any moment, for any reason, an employee can give another employee a $50 bonus for doing something great. Now, this is still money, but it's a small enough amount of money that it's not going to distort anybody's behavior. And most important, it's not an if-then reward. It's not contingent. It's not saying, hey, if you clean up your desk nicely, I'll give you $50. It's someone helps you out of a jam. Someone does something unexpected for a customer. Boom, on the spot, you can give that person a $50 bonus. Now, what everybody always says, oh, don't people abuse this? Don't people abuse this? And the truth is, they do not. Because, I mean, I think if people do abuse that, it says something more about the people you've hired and about the culture you've allowed to develop than it does about the mechanism itself. But what that does is it gives people, again, quick feedback, which I think is lacking in the workplace, and it's from a peer. So it's not controlling in the way that, you know, if bosses handed this out, I think it would be a different story. But if your peer can give you something, I think it's actually meaningful. And what's happened, Darren, which is so interesting in the companies that are doing this, is that it's actually had, I think, a better effect on the givers rather than the recipients. Mm. Because what it's done in a way is that it's made people conscious of how much other people are contributing. Mm. And by simply having that kind of conversation, that itself is a form of feedback, noticing that people are doing a great job. And so that's just another way that it enriches the feedback environment. So there are a lot of unmastery. There's some really great opportunities out there to enrich the amount of feedback in this feedback desert we call the workplace.
Well, Dan, I have to say, just the idea that you gave about the $50 immediate feedback is such a great idea because, again, as you mentioned, it's not just the person who's receiving the $50. It's everyone else that is looking for opportunities.
Exactly.
To express thanks or to look for what people are doing right. And that's, I think, the big mental transition that would take place. Everybody's looking or being acutely aware of what everybody else is doing wrong. You know, what is coming in late, who didn't do it well, you know, what was missed, and this idea of trying to find ways where people are wowing or going the extra mile and rewarding them publicly or even privately with a bonus, I think would be a real game changer for the internal culture. I think it's a great idea.
I think it's fantastic. I think your analysis of it is really good, and I haven't thought about it quite that way, that we do spend a lot of time looking for what people are doing wrong and not enough time looking at what people are doing right. It is, as you say, a form of gratitude, a form of peer-to-peer recognition, and that's really, really powerful.
Now, before we wrap things up, Dan, talk to us about the most important thing that listeners can take away from this conversation on the topic of motivation. I'm a big believer in, you know, let's just start with the first step so that we don't go with the day ending and nothing has changed. What can they do today or before the week is out, to start taking some action on reorienting their systems or their culture to put some of these other and more powerful and compelling motivators in place? What's one thing they could do today?
Well, they could set out, find a time this month for their employees to do what you can think of as non-commissioned work. Mm. That is, as I mentioned before, like an artist has commissions, but an artist does non-commissioned work. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that the non-commissioned work is more creative than the commissioned work. Twitter recently did what they called a hack week, where they took a week, told their employees, don't work on your regular job. work on whatever you feel like for the next week and we'll see what happens. And so I would find sometime this month for one day of non-commissioned work where people can do whatever they want, work on whatever they want, and then have a fun meeting where people show what they've created. I think folks will blow your socks off.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Great, great takeaway to focus on. Well, I know that I'm even more motivated to bring the best out in others as a result of some of the tips and ideas that I wrote down during our time together. So thank you, Dan, for showing us how to get the most from those that we motivate every day, including ourselves. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Darren, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Success Magazine Audio, copyright Success Media, all rights reserved.